This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The pandemic is changing the way we live, and for tens of thousands of Floridians, it's not just a matter of hunkering down and waiting for business to resume. Many of those suddenly without work are also wondering about how to pay rent and keep a roof over their heads. And while there's a hold on evictions in place right now, some tenants say they're still being served eviction notices. There's also the question of what the pandemic means for landlords, with some tenants unable to pay rent and the economy in dire straits. Alex Mesdag is an attorney at Mesdag, Wall & Hamilton in Winter Park. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matthew.
We're also joined by Anna Escamani. She's a Democratic State Representative from Orlando. Anna, thank you as well.
Of course.
The state of Florida has offered some help for renters in the weeks after this pandemic began to unfold, namely suspending evictions for 45 days. Anna, what does this actually mean in practice? Because you've been fielding a lot of inquiries from constituents, right? So what does this mean for folks who are renting and maybe suddenly out of work?
Right. Unfortunately, I think a lot of confusion, because in particular, Orange County was taking some steps initially to provide support to renters in different ways. And then the actual 45-day suspension only mentions residential renters, not commercial renters. And essentially what the governor did through executive order on April 2nd is put into place this 45-day suspension, pausing mortgage foreclosures of any type of property and residential evictions. However, Section 3 of this executive order does state that nothing in the executive order shall be construed as relieving an individual from their obligation to make mortgage payments or rent payments. So there really is not any type of break given when it comes to payment that folks have to make when it comes to their leases or even the mortgages. Mm-hmm. And so operationally, what we've seen is some landlords providing opportunities for flexibility. And then we've seen landlords, especially on the commercial side, really move towards eviction and actually post what's a 3-day eviction notice. And talking to the Orange County Sheriff's Office, there is no penalty for posting up a 3-day eviction notice. However, the next step will not be preceded because of not just the 45-day suspension on residential renters, but also the fact that Florida Supreme Court is not facilitating any meetings for possession. And also the Orange County Sheriff's Office is not engaging in any of the process of eviction as well. So the good news is that that 3-day eviction notice, at least to my understanding, is kind of like the only direction something can go for now. But I think the biggest fear I have alongside others is once we get through this crisis, is there going to be a long list of evictions just waiting to happen because folks are struggling to access relief they're trying to get. And small businesses are still waiting for loans to be able to pay their bills on time as well.
And it is, to your point, it's typically the sheriff's office. It'll be deputies who will serve eviction notices.
Correct. I mean, so there's no penalty for posting a 3-day eviction notice. And if there is no response to that 3-day eviction notice, typically the process is the 5-day eviction notice with the clerk of court. Mm-hmm. And so Chief Judge has already directed the clerk of court here in our circuit to not process any of those 5-day eviction notices. And of course, law enforcement is involved in that process as well. And as I already noted, they're not engaging right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alex, let me bring you into this conversation. Obviously, there's two sides to this coin, right? Landlords rely on the folks who pay them rent to keep them in business. I mean, for some folks, that is their business. So what is the state doing for those landlords who may be worried about losing, you know, the next batch of rent and what that's going to mean for their business?
We've been doing primarily work on the commercial side of transactions. And really, there hasn't been any relief on the commercial side for commercial landlords. It's really been a decision by landlords whether to try to work with a tenant and keep them through these difficult times, or really enforce the rights under the leases. The one thing, and keeping in mind also that if there is a mortgage on the property, to engage their lenders, because there may be some approval requirements for the lender to step in and give in order for the landlord to modify or restructure a lease to give a sort of relief to the tenants. I will say, I think, Anna, I think you're correct, everything that you said. The one thing I would even say is I don't know that technically a three-day notice is something that a landlord could engage in on the residential side, because the way I read this, the governor's order, is that it speaks to holding off, suspending any action for under any statute that provides for an eviction. And filing a three-day notice is one of the requirements under the statute to proceed. So arguably, I think a landlord who does initiate a three-day notice now may have to repost that three-day notice once the toll is lifted.
Alex, you know, one word we've heard thrown around probably too much in the last few weeks is unprecedented, right? But this must be an unusual situation for a law firm that kind of advises businesses in this situation. What was your kind of go-to strategy for advising people, saying, what do we do in this situation?
Well, that's a good question and good inquiry, really, because, you know, for us real estate attorneys who are involved on the transactional side, you know, we're working to facilitate the projects and transactions and bring them to fruition. So there's been a definite slowdown on projects that we've been working on. The pause button has been hit on some of them. And so, you know, clients that are developers or landlords or looking to acquire property or develop it may have seen a slowdown on new projects. And we've in turn seen that, been affected by that. However, those same landlords that, you know, were looking to sign up new leases as part of their ownership are now having to deal with tenants coming to them for relief. And so what we've done, we've had to do is pivot and be in a position to help our clients navigate that part of their ownership of an asset. It's trying to facilitate, you know, protecting the client in this environment, keeping them from being bound by maybe things they may be negotiating and avoiding those pitfalls, and also making sure that they are engaging their lenders and not doing things that may cause them to be in breach of any of their loan documents. It's more sort of just distress kind of work that we're working on that we saw back in the 2008-2009 crisis, but it's much broader right now.
Right. Anna, what kind of stories have you been hearing and seeing on social media and people just contacting you? Because, you know, one of the things I've noted is that people are saying you're actually one of the lawmakers who's responding and saying, let's see what we can do to help. I mean, that's the job of a lawmaker in a time like this, but I know it's obviously frantically busy, but what, you know, what are you hearing? What stands out?
We're hearing everything, Matthew. We are getting messages from tenants who are experiencing a difficulty in making rent, and the landlord basically pursuing an eviction process, or at the very least threatening eviction. We've also heard stories of rent being increased. And in fact, one of our affordable housing companies was planning to increase rent this month based on area median income formulas provided by HUD. And fortunately, after conversations with this company, they decide not to pursue the rent increase right now. And so I have been in communication with landlords as well. And actually this past weekend, you know, I get copied in email exchanges between tenants and their landlords. And I'm very sensitive to that because I know that those are private conversations. But when your lawmaker gets pulled in, it's not something I can ignore. So I actually called both the landlord and the tenant and just tried to almost serve as a mediator as much as I can. And so it really has been challenging because I think the reality is that, you know, we empathize with every person in this situation. But I do stress that, you know, my priority is for us to be able to get back to normal and make sure that we don't lose small businesses through this process or see a homeless rate because of evictions. And so I really try to just maintain as much as we can of stopping this moving wall of everyone's monthly payments, because the other wall of benefits is not here yet. And eventually, hopefully they'll match up and then those monthly payments can be met because folks will have benefits coming in. But that's the harsh reality, is that whether they're small businesses or independent laid off workers, everyone's trying to access government benefits to continue the, you know, the economic cycles, if you will. But because of the delay on both sides, of federal relief and state relief, that people are feeling the pressure, whether they're landlords or tenants. But I really, really encourage landlords to do what they can to provide that relief. And I really echo Alex's point of talking to your lender, because there are many lenders that are providing forbearance and other type of tools to alleviate the stress of a landlord. But keep in mind, I mean, we're talking about tenants and landlords who have never missed a payment on either side. So I think for a lot of folks, it's just the stress of navigating this and never having navigated before. And we're here to help calm people down and to just restore a little bit of humanity and to try to keep things, you know, as comfortable as possible for both parties involved, knowing how critically important it is that people can stay in their homes, especially while we're sheltering in place. People need a home to shelter in. And it's very hard for me to tolerate, you know, this situation leading to anyone becoming homeless, whether it's someone with a lease or someone in our motels and hotels. And we've also been helping families who live east but pay weekly rates at hotels. One in particular, a mom contacted us who was going to be removed because she couldn't make her rent with her family. And so we were able to convene different levels of government to come together. And with a letter from Congresswoman Val Demings to this motel operator, they decided to not remove any families. So we're also doing our part, you know, to handle situations case by case, but to also look at it from a macro level of just how this plays in everyone's health and well-being long-term.
I want to just pick up on a point you made there, Anna, and something you were talking about before as well, Alex. I mean, the notion of, the lenders, banks deferring mortgage payments, that I think we're hearing that happen at the homeowner level. But Alex, is it something that commercial lenders are also doing, or are they a little bit slow to get in on the game?
I'll be frank with you, and just my experience, and this is more working with regional banks and local banks, is that the banks have been very flexible and understanding of borrowers' situations. And you know, without going into names, I have seen bank lenders who, if a borrower comes to them asking for relief because, in fact, tenants are not paying them, the banks, without being judge or jury, will grant a forbearance. One bank told me we are not requiring any payments for 90 days, and then we'll reassess the situation. The money's not forgiven, but it'll just be tacked on the back. Another lender I spoke to, again, commercial property, commercial lender, said we are giving 6 months forbearance. Again, not forgiven, but we're not charging any points, no fees. So we're going to tack it and extend a loan by the number of payments we're deferring.
Right. I mean, I guess it makes sense for banks to keep their customers, right? They don't really want to lose them, so they'll do what they can to keep them. And the same would go for a landlord, right? If you've got a good tenant, it's in your interest to try and keep them there.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just going back to the lenders, I think there's been some directives as well from the OCC at the federal level encouraging the banks to work with borrowers. So whereas maybe in the past, if a loan were involving forbearance, that debt would be considered troubled. And so that would require the lender to increase the capital that would be required to in relation to that loan, and lessen the ability of the amounts that the bank can loan out. But there are directives for the banks to work with the lenders with borrowers, and that those loans wouldn't be treated as troubled and triggering those increased capital requirements. Mm-hmm. Going back to the landlord situation, I agree with you. I think it just would behoove a landlord to work, especially with long-term tenant who's been a tenant for 5, 6, 7 years, 10 years plus. One, ask yourself, it's the right thing to do to the extent you can do it. And two, just when you think about it, okay, if you're going to enforce the lease terms, that tenant can't pay, you're going to evict them. One, there's a moratorium. Technically, it doesn't apply to commercial evictions, but just in my experience and in speaking with judges are not really doing anything. You can file motions with them But they will be essentially, you know, stacked and lay there and stacked until the moratorium is lifted. So nothing's really going to happen on the commercial side as well. And, you know, say you do get a tenant out and they leave, you know, who are you going to backfill it with? There's just a dearth of businesses that are in need to sign new leases, obviously, depending on the industry they're in. Mm-hmm.
I have to agree with that. I don't think it's a smart, even business decision. I've heard that from many of my conservative friends who are surprised that we are getting phone calls of landlords threatening eviction to commercial tenants, because it just doesn't make sense right now. Why do you want an empty building when someone is trying to pay rent and will pay rent to you very, very soon? And I just want to add too that there is a federal moratorium as well on some of the federally backed apartments. And so just for folks to know that, if you live in a federally covered property, which could include things like FHA, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, HUD, anything that is a property that receives low-income housing tax credits, also known as the LIHTC, Public Housing Section 8. These are all different types of housing programs that are federally covered and should be also protected under a federal moratorium on evictions.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of going back to the, you know, why this is such a big problem right now. And Anna, you were saying that obviously the counties, the local authorities were trying to put a stopgap. I mean, Orange County had this rental assistance program. Their plan was to help, 1,000 families or 1,500 families.
Or something. 1,500 like, families, yeah.
They got
1,000 applicants.
Right. So, I mean, that sort of goes to show the desperation that people are in, and also the fact that there just really isn't this bridge to help people, you know, get through to when federal money or even state money is coming in. I'm wondering, you know, as a state lawmaker, what has this experience taught you about some of the gaps in the system and things that we need to be doing now to try and fix it, and then maybe some long-term fixes as well?
Well, I think it's reaffirmed some of the points that we've made for a very long time, that Florida has an affordable housing crisis, especially Central Florida. Our service-driven economy has led to an environment where people cannot have the ability to save money because they're only making enough to pay off their bills per month. It's also a reflection of just a greater need when it comes to rent stabilization programs. And I know that's often controversial, but I'm a renter myself. I have a lease that I pay every month, and I'm very blessed to have the ability to do that. But you know, I still have a job right now. A lot of families don't. And so I've tried to always bring a renter perspective to the legislature, since so many of my colleagues are property owners and often don't put themselves in the shoes of a renter today. Especially again, we also have those who have no lease because they live in motels, and we're doing everything we can to provide support case by case. And I even wrote a $200 check to someone to sign on to their lease. They were just $200 short, and with Orange County's program being delayed, I was like, okay, who's your landlord? And so, you know, we're doing everything we can, but it needs larger systematic change. And I think that's a larger conversation to have about affordable housing, about the cost of living here, about our wages, a larger conversation that we have to have post-COVID into the next legislative session.
Well, Anna Eskimani, Democratic State Representative from Orlando, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Alex Mesdag, attorney at Mesdag, Wall & Hamilton in Winter Park, thanks as well.
You're welcome. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you for having me on.
Still to come, creativity in quarantine. I'll talk to best-selling novelist Don Winslow about his new book, about how he keeps track of the sprawling cast of characters in his novels, and whether he's inspired to write pandemic fiction himself. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Author Don Winslow is best known for his crime fiction, including The Power of the Dog trilogy focused on the drug trade. Like many of us, he's stuck at home waiting out the pandemic. He says it's kind of like the isolation of writing a novel anyway. I talked to Winslow about his new book, a collection of short novels, what he's reading and watching right now, and about letting go of your work once it gets adapted into a film or TV series. Well, Don Winslow's books include his trilogy about the war on drugs, The Power of the Dog, The Cartel, and The Border, and his new book is a collection of novellas called Broken. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So readers are pretty familiar with your epic fiction. Why the change of pace with these shorter works?
Yeah, you know, the answer's in the question. For the past 20-something years, I've been writing epics, you know, really long books. During that time, though, I had ideas for other stories that I knew weren't epics. You know, they didn't take place over decades and continents. They were in sort of one location with one or two major characters in a short period of time. And so after I finished the trilogy, which was a third of my life, by the way, you know, I took a breath and thought, okay, I'm going to go back to some of these story ideas that I had and see about this sort of mid-length. I knew they weren't full novels. I knew they weren't short stories. They were somewhere in the middle, the novella, if you will. And so I gave it a shot.
Have you written short stories or that length fiction in the past, or is this kind of new territory for you?
Yeah, it's new territory. I've written a bunch of short stories, but they were just that, you know, and these are two or three times the length of those. So, yeah, completely, completely uncharted territory for me.
Did you find as you were going through the writing process, though, something was sparking and you're thinking you might come back to some of those characters and develop them a little further?
Possibly. You know, never say never. I have no immediate plans to do that. But there are a few of these characters, yeah, that I, you know, immodestly, I really kind of liked. And so, yeah, maybe they'll show up. And then, you know, in these books, too, in Broken, there are characters from past novels that come back and intrude themselves into these. You know, these are characters that readers have been asking me about for years. You know, whatever happened to Neil? Are we ever going to see Boone Daniels again? And so this was kind of an opportunity to do that.
How do you keep track of them all? Do you have like a big board with sticky notes all over it so you can sort of figure out what these characters are doing while you're not writing about them?
No, I'm afraid it's just my jumbled brain, you know. But at times I had to go back. It's a little embarrassing. I had to go back to the previous novels and you know, refresh my memory as to where they were and what they've been doing and how old they were and all that kind of stuff. But no, I don't outline because I want to be open to the possibility of surprises. And I'm always afraid if I really outline, because I know myself, I would stick to that outline slavishly, and I don't want to do that.
Well, to that point, though, I mean, the research that must go into something like the Cartel trilogy, I mean, you point out that you spent a third of your life working on that. It's got a pretty strong basis in fact. So how do you balance those two disparate things? If you're not so much into outlines, but you're also bringing this weight of research into the novel.
Yeah. Well, I have to draw a really clear line. It's a great question because I do a lot of documentation. So for a book like Cartel or The Border or Power of the Dog, I will have half a room full of documents and notes and, you know, thousands of notes on computer. And so those I carefully organize. You know, I always do a chronology and then I do it by theme and by person and by topic. Then, though, when I'm writing the novel, I have to be really aware of shutting that off. You know what I mean? That I have to remind myself, you're not writing history. You're not writing nonfiction. You're writing realistic fiction and you need to keep it realistic. That's my deal with the reader. But you can, you know, change chronology. You can alter events as long as you're being faithful to, you know, to the reality. So it's a great question because sometimes I struggle with that. My education is a historian. And, you know, later on I was a trial consultant. So I was preparing, you know, very, very factual, you know, analyses and briefs for people. So I have to be very aware, you know, turn that side of you off and write fiction.
Did you think you would be writing historical books then, or did you always know you wanted to be a novelist?
I always knew I wanted to be a novelist. I don't know that I admitted that to myself, you know, until my late 20s, early 30s. I have a bent toward history, and that's mostly what I read. But I always wanted to be a novelist, and, you know, very lucky it worked out that way.
Mm-hmm. What are you reading right now then? Do you have some tomes on your nightstand?
Let's see, because I'm right there. I'm reading a classic old Western history, Bernard DeVoto's The Course of Empire, about the American West. I have a book, Kenya, the First Explorers, and I just finished James Michener's semi-autobiographical novel, The Fires of Spring.
Wow. Okay. So, and let me kind of pivot from that to the setting. How important is it for you to have visited the place that you're writing about?
Pretty important. Yeah. Yeah, I try to always go. You can't always. And you know, look, you can always get on an airplane. You can't get in a time machine. And so sometimes, depending on what year I'm setting something in, it would be pointless to go because the place you're writing about in reality no longer exists. But location, you know, particularly in these stories, is key. I consider location very, very close to character. You know, we all come from somewhere and our environment, you know, definitely impacts us. So it's pretty important to me. Yeah. When I can do it, I do it.
Thinking about the war on drugs, is that over for you as far as a setting for fiction, or is it something you might come back to?
I think it's over. But, you know, I've said that so many times that people just don't believe me anymore. And I'm not sure I believe me anymore. You know, but when I said it, I meant it. You know, that trilogy was never intended to be a trilogy. When I wrote the first book, I said, I'm done with it. I'm done with it. I'll never come back here. When I finished the second book, The Cartel, I said the same thing and promised my wife I wouldn't go back to it. And then I ended up writing the third, you know, The Border. But I think now I've told the story that I need to tell. I think it's done, but, you know, it's pointless for me to say I'm done with it because no one believes me.
And it will have some kind of life beyond the printed page, right? I mean, it was going to be a film, and then FX has the rights to it now. Is that right?
Yeah. FX is doing it as a series and discussing, you know, around 5 to 7 seasons. So it's, I think that gives it kind of the time and the space to breathe and be a little fuller and to incorporate more aspects of Mexican culture and life that sometimes get neglected in these things, you know, so I'm pretty happy about it.
How much input do you have into that?
Quite a bit. Worked really closely, you know, my agent and friend and sometimes co-conspirator Shane Salerno and a guy named Daniel Zeldman, who's the showrunner, and we talk a lot. And, you know, look at each other's work. And so I've had quite a bit of input to it. Now, when it, you know, goes into production, I probably, you know, will look at things, but I'm not going to be on the set or anything like that, you know, a lot. Because I, you know, look, I'm busy writing books, you know, I mean, that's kind of.
But you know, when you read a book and then, you know, later on down the line, it gets made into a movie or something, you go and see it, and sometimes it doesn't, you're like, that's not the image I had in my mind. Do you kind of worry about that for your own stuff?
Oh, sure. But look, you come to a certain kind of a peace with it. And it's funny, Lee Child and I were talking about this last night, you know, that the book's always going to be the book. It's not going to change. You can always come back to the book and read it. It is what it is. But the film, I think the film and the novel can be side by side, you know, and I'm aware that novels and film and TV have different needs. You know, what sometimes it amazes me, frankly, that what works as a line of dialogue when you read it in a book might not work when it's 30 feet high and kinetic and colorful and coming out of the mouth of an actor. Mm-hmm. You know, they are different breeds of cat. And we have to be aware of that. At the same time, you know, I want the director and the producer to be faithful to the substance, you know what I mean, the spirit of the book, and not to do, like, make, you know, gratuitous changes that, you know, for no reason.
Right. Let me just ask, if I could, about what you're doing during this pandemic. Whereabouts are you hunkering down at the moment?
Well, I'm at home, like everybody. You know, we live in a rural area, live on an old ranch. in mm-hmm. Southern California, which is pretty isolated anyway. The office where I work is a minute up a dirt road, and I'm alone. So in that regard, life hasn't changed that much. You know, mm-hmm. I usually spend all day alone anyway. So, yeah, I'm at the house, and, you know, when I'm not working, I'm sitting at home reading or, you know, binge-watching TV or, you know, streaming movies like everybody else, I guess.
Right. There's obviously a whole genre of kind of pandemic or disaster fiction. Is that something that inspires you as well?
God, no. That's the last thing I would go to right now, you know, because, I mean, we're living it, you know, it's on 24/7. I want to get away from it a little bit. I watched the great Michael Mann movie Thief with James Caan and Tuesday Weld, and watching some classical noir, The Asphalt Jungle, Sterling Hayden, and that kind of thing.
Well, Don Winslow, his new book is a collection of short novels, Broken. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time, and you be well and safe and all that good stuff, okay?
Likewise. Still to come, could the pandemic teach us some things about how to live better? Stay-at-home orders are forcing people to rethink the way they act with teams around them, their families, friends, and co-workers. We'll talk to retired astronaut Nicole Stott about teamwork, isolation, and finding beauty in unexpected places. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Could the pandemic teach us some things about how to live better? Retired astronaut Nicole Stott thinks so. She says some of the lessons that astronauts learn about teamwork, isolation, and resilience could also be applied to the way we're dealing with this crisis here on Earth. Well, Nicole Stott, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Matthew.
Let me just ask you about how you're approaching this pandemic. I mean, you're a former astronaut. You've got an engineering background. I imagine you're probably good at kind of setting up a routine and following it. So what's your daily routine like?
There is a daily routine, although I have to tell you, my son, who is in high school, just started into the schooling from home thing. And so I'm in a bit of, you know, a place where I'm having to figure out how to reorganize the day that I had kind of gotten used to my routine, you know. And I've worked from home for about 4 years now, so that part of it wasn't in all of this kind of isolation wasn't a change for me. But I am feeling a little bit more in this week what a lot of people might be going through, where it's really very different now, you know. Things are put on us that we might not have chosen ourselves. And although I've always wanted to homeschool my son, might change my mind next week. but I think that's it. It's like there's this little twist on it that then requires you to really look around and think about things a little bit differently. And that certainly is what happens when you go to space, you know. You're used to living a certain way here on Earth, even if you're organized and have a routine. And then now all of a sudden you're put into a place that, you know, the International Space Station, while it's not tiny, I mean, it's really kind of a ginormous volume to work in, but you are confined to it. And now you have to work within both those physical bounds of it, but also the schedule that the ground is sending you every day, and kind of the limitations on the resources that you have and things like that. And I think that's what a lot of us are going through right now.
It's interesting kind of that perspective, but it occurs to me too that, you know, you do a massive amount of training as an astronaut, getting ready to go into space and spend time on the International Space Station, but things can go wrong, right? No matter how much preparation you do, no matter how much technology you've got behind you, stuff can happen that isn't supposed to happen. And to your point about people being thrust into situations they haven't really signed up for, there's a little bit of that in what you do as an astronaut, right? You've got to be prepared for the unexpected.
Yeah, I think absolutely. In fact, I would say probably 99.9% of all the training we do in one way or another has an aspect of, oh no, what can go wrong, you know, associated with it. And a lot of that is because that same level of training, actually, I'd take it up a 0.1%, and that 100% of what we do is really about how do you work effectively as a team to have a successful mission. And responding to things going wrong is going to be one of those things you have to do as a team and that you want to be most prepared for. And yeah, I think in our, you know, our day-to-day lives here, we're not really considering that as much. You know, our hope is that things are always going to go well. And so it's a little bit different way to have to live and work. And in space, I can tell you, when you do prepare, it's beautiful when you see it all come together, you know, that you're not, I don't think, actively worrying about something happening all the time, but you're aware that it could happen. And then because of the training we've had, when it does, everybody just comes together, rallies in a way that, you know, you're making sure that the whole crew is accounted for and that you're responding to the emergency in, you know, with the immediate actions that need to take place. And then you're following that up with, okay, how do we make sure everybody's, you know, really under control now and, you know, things are safe for us to continue working. And we're doing a little bit of that now, aren't we? We're kind of having to rally both as our families or as individuals in our homes. We're having to count on, I mean, a bigger thing than I've ever seen in my life, you know, kind of the first time we've had to work really as crew on Spaceship Earth here, even though perhaps we should be doing that a lot more for other things. And figuring out how we're going to respond to it and then move on afterwards.
The first time, your first mission to the International Space Station, what was the sense of being, you know, in that confined space like did that sort of take you by surprise? Were you ready for that? You know, just the knowledge that you were going to be spending some considerable time in this space that you know there's no way out now. You got to wait until the ride back to Earth.
Yeah, you know, I never felt trapped, you know, or oh my gosh, I got to get out of here kind of thing. And I think that comes from all the wonderful training that we do in the simulators, although, you know, nothing is ever exactly what it's like going to be in space. But I mean, I remember floating from the space shuttle into the space station and feeling like, oh my gosh, this feels familiar, you know, the way it kind of surrounded me and even some of the smells of it. And, you know, yeah, we were all floating. That was very different. And, you know, to the way you needed to move around and stuff, it took a little time to get used to that. But the sense of it felt familiar because of the training we do. I think one of the reasons that we don't, or at least I didn't feel like, oh gosh, I need to get out of here, is because you have some of the most, actually I would say the most spectacular views out the window that you can imagine. And so while you couldn't get out into nature, you could be looking through these windows and kind of transcend where you were and feel like you were part of it in a whole new way. Like, oh my gosh, I'm looking at this place that's my home, that's a planet. And look at all of these glorious colors coming together, glowing in front of me and changing all the time. And so you're never tired of that. And I think that was kind of a way of getting out. And that's what I'm doing right now too, is, you know, I'm looking at this like, how do I appreciate what's out my window in a whole new way than I may have ever before? And I'm really encouraging people to do that too. And when you can get outside and actually be part of it, you know, there's something very healthy about that as well.
Mm-hmm. And you spent time at NASA's underwater lab too, right? Off of the Keys?
Yeah, that was absolutely, Matthew. I mean, that was absolutely, I highly encourage you to go check that out if you ever can. The Aquarius facility, it's off the coast of Key Largo. It sits about 60 feet underwater in this protected, you know, marine preserve area. And it's the habitat itself, Aquarius, is about the size of one of the modules on the space station. And so I had the chance to live with a crew of six in that place for 18 days, and absolutely the best analog, the best preparation for what it was going to be like to go live and work in space.
Does every astronaut who's preparing for a mission to the ISS spend some time in that facility, or is it just specific missions?
I think there they're trying to do that, you know, as people are getting targeted for, especially for the long duration flights, they're making an attempt, as much as I can tell, in the last, you know, 5 to maybe even 10 years, they have been doing that. And it's such, oh my gosh, I remember after the 18 days was up and we were getting ready to surface, you know, to come back up to the surface. And one of my crewmates was Ronnie Guerin. He's an astronaut as well. And we were in the same class and we sat at one of the portholes in the galley and we're looking out and neither of us had flown yet. And we both just looked out and then we looked at each other and we're like, oh my gosh, you know, if we never get to fly in space, this has been the most incredible experience. It was like another way of getting to know this planet that we live on, but being surrounded by it instead of surrounding it, you know, kind of an inner space perspective on, you know, how much more is going on around us all the time, the life on Earth, the way we live and survive here that we just don't see every day unless we take advantage of an opportunity. And I would say like the one we have right now to look a little bit differently around us.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot going on under the ocean that we just have no idea about yet because we haven't been able to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of exploration, too, you know, I mean, you've gone to some pretty impressive places on this planet. I mean, there's a lot of otherworldly places right here on Earth that, you know, if you didn't know it was on Earth, you might think it's Venus or something, you know, and I think that's, you know, that's open for us to explore. And we could do that through the interweb right now too. You know, there's a lot of things we could be just raising questions about and looking up and I don't know. Are you familiar with a nature photographer named David Litschwager?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Amazing guy. And he did this in terms of like looking at what's around us and really understanding how much life, you know, we share this planet with. He did a project called 1 Cubic Foot, where he took these little frames that were the size 1 cubic foot and put them in different places around the planet. And he worked with scientists to determine what are these places that would best represent the life on Earth. And then put these in these places. And then over the period of the day, kept track of all of the life that was either in that cubic foot or came through it. And then photo documented it in a really stunning way. And they actually have kids projects that can go along with it. I think it's Smithsonian on their website that has where kids or schools can do this same kind of experiment. And incredible, the kind of life in our own backyard that we pay attention is there sharing it with us.
Now, you're an artist as well. Nicole, were you creating art before you became an astronaut? Was this something that being up in space kind of inspired you to pursue?
Yeah, I grew up kind of artsy craftsy, I guess. I like to paint. I like to woodwork. You know, I like the hands-on things, creating things. And painting was one of those. I would never say that I've had any formal training. It's all been experimental, but that's okay. And when I was getting ready to go to space the first time, I think like most astronauts, I was really concerned about making sure I understood what all the procedures and, you know, tasks were, the work that I was going to do while I was there. And I'm very thankful to one of my ground support people, Mary Jane Anderson, who was helping me get all the stuff that I was able to take with me to space together. And she reminded me that I'd be living there too. And she said, you know, Nicole, you know, there will be some free time there. And while most of it, you'll probably spend in front of the window, you might want to think about bringing something with you that you enjoy doing here on Earth. So long story short, I brought a little watercolor kit with me, painted a view that I had seen out the window. And of course, you know, in space where you're traveling on the space station, at least at 5 miles a second, you know, you're not sitting in front of the window and painting that because it's gone before you can get the brush to the paper. So I printed out a picture of this little chain of islands on the northern coast of Venezuela called Los Roques and painted that. And it's really honestly been the inspiration for the work I've done after retiring from NASA, both from a personal artwork standpoint, as well as the work that we're doing with the Space for Art Foundation.
There's quite a few former NASA astronauts who've gone over to the commercial sector and are preparing for commercial missions back into space. Is that something on your mind as well? Would that be something you might do?
I would, you know, I'd love to do that. I'm really looking forward to seeing my friends fly again on these new spacecraft. The first flight that's scheduled or planned, I guess, at this point with SpaceX for relatively soon, I think. The two crew members are Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley, who are both in the class of 2000, which is my astronaut class. And so I'm very anxious to see that safely happen and for us to get on this path of, you know, flying more regularly again and getting more crew members to and from the space station. And then how that can help us think about what we're going to do beyond the space station as well. You know, the fact that we're thinking and planning to go back to the moon, I'm so excited about that and would love to do that. Yeah. I might need to become independently wealthy. I don't know that my art will do that for me, but I would love to do that. And then, you know, and then this vision of the future where, you know, at one point we are establishing a presence on Mars, and I don't like to go colony. I'm more about settlement and presence, but I think there's wonderful things to come for us. And what the way we work in space, you know, the relationships internationally that we've developed through the International Space Station program and how we live and work on this mechanical life support system in space, it's just such a wonderful, you know, perfect example for how we should be living like crew down here on Spaceship Earth. And I'm really hopeful as we're going through this challenge, this worry, this, you know, this experience that we're all having together as Earthlings right now. You know, there are no discriminators in what we're dealing with right now. And I really hope that we come out the other side feeling like we need to work this way together about every challenge we have here on the planet. And, you know, that's my see it, be it vision of it. I'm really hopeful that we'll be seeing that and being it.
You're already seeing some of that, I think. I mean, just to your point about people working together, you're seeing folks from the commercial space industry step up and try and kind of figure out engineering solutions to some of the immediate challenges, right? Like, for example, Elon Musk donating ventilators, and then I was reading about Virgin Galactic designing a kind of cheapish ventilator that could be, you know, production could be scaled up and that could be sent out. So, I mean, does it seem to you like there are some things for this particular challenge that there's an engineering solution if people could only just kind of figure out how to work together?
Absolutely. And I think I love that you say that, because I think we're seeing it everywhere, and not just, you know, not just like from the space industry or the, what you would think of as the place you'd expect it in the medical supply industry, but we're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing students, you know, at universities, 3D printing things that they're sharing with others that are working. You know, XPRIZE is putting out all new challenges for, you know, solving this problem quickly and effectively. And I work with, as a consultant to ILC Dover, who's the company that's been making our spacesuits for forever, and who actually is a partner with us on the Space for Art Foundation, making the art spacesuits. And they're, you know, they're looking at how do they, you know, expedite the products that they already, you know, had in line for their customers, but how do they use the skill they have with protective equipment to, you know, help solve these problems as well. I think it's just, this is how we, I really believe that this is what's buried in our human nature, and that this time of stillness, perhaps this time of reflection, is going to allow us, you know, I try to be optimistic and realistic too. I think it should really allow us to acknowledge that side of our humanity, and to take it forward, not just look at it like, oh, we're solving this problem, but to look at it as a way we can work together on a scale that, yes, is exponentially larger than what we do as six people or, you know, thousands of people on the Earth for a space station program to work peacefully and successfully, but to extrapolate that to how we can work as crew members here on Spaceship Earth.
Well, Nicole Stott, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners, and because we're working from home.
Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Monica Seeley. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Independent public service journalism has never been more important than it is right now. From COVID-19 to the 2020 elections, WMFE is here to help you make sense of it all. The news you trust is made possible by your support at WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty.
Thanks for listening.